Hello, everybody, and we are back again for another episode of the Cinema Recall Podcast. This is the Cinema Recall Podcast, which can be found on thatmomentsin.com. I am your host, Laverne, and on today's episode, we are going to be looking back at the 1997 sci-fi extravaganza, The Fifth Element, directed by Luc Besson and starring Bruce Willis and Mila Jovovich, Chris Tucker, Ian Holm. I know those are the people that I'm forgetting about, but that's okay because I brought along my good guest, Paul Hawkins from the Blockbusters podcast to help me out with that. Hello, sir.
Hello. And yes, just to name the one you did forget, you were forgetting Gary Oldman there.
Gary Oldman. Fuck, the biggest name in that movie. I cannot believe I messed up and forgot Gary Oldman. It's funny, too, because I remember one of the actors in this, what the hell is his name now? He was in There's Something About Mary. He played Irvin in this. He has a small role in this. And I'll tell you about his name later on when we go into this movie a little bit here. But yeah, Fifth Element here, like I said before, a sci-fi film directed by Luc Besson. This was his follow-up to The Professional. And, you know, I have to say, and correct me if I'm wrong, Paul, but I think this was the only really big blockbuster that Luc Besson himself directed.
I would say so, yeah. And to be 100% honest, this is also my only Luc Besson film that I'd seen for most of my life because I just never had the chance to see any of his others. So.
Oh. Growing up there, I mean, I remember seeing La Femme Nikita because we had my dad brought home a dubbed VHS tape of La Femme Nikita. Oh. So I remember seeing that. And then, like, I remember The Professional came out, and I recognized the director's name, and I had no idea that La Femme Nikita was actually a French film. I just thought the actors were speaking really bad English. So then I found out there actually was an original subtitle version of that. But, oh, well, I got to check that out. And then I saw The Professional, and I was blown away by that movie. In fact, we could do another whole episode about all the great scenes there. And when this came out to theaters, I had to go, like, right away check this out. And I felt like so cool with my friends because I was the only one that knew about Luc Besson and everything. And, you know, they were going to see it because there was a cute redhead who was wearing practically next to nothing. So, like, give me your kind of your first thoughts about the movie, you know, like when you saw it, or would you think of it now still, or?
All right. Well, to be honest, I can't remember if I saw it in the cinema, but I definitely remember watching this, and I think this was the first real action film that I kind of enjoyed, and I'm sure it was the science fiction element to that that really helped, because I tend to find action films a little on the boring side, but this one really kept my attention, especially with Gary Oldman before I knew who Gary Oldman was, just being that really weird villain.
Yeah.
And then, as we'll talk about in a bit, just Ruby Rod.
Oh, but yes.
That just that character in and of itself kind of makes the film for me, so... So yeah, I very much enjoyed this, and I'm always surprised when someone says they haven't seen it, because I feel like most of the people that I grew up with saw it, and some of them liked it, some of them didn't. And so it was one of those things of maybe not everyone liked it, but everyone saw it, and then I ran into a bunch of people that were like, The Fifth Element? No, I haven't seen that. It's like, you haven't seen it? How have you not seen it? I don't get it.
This is like probably one of Bruce Willis's best action roles, because growing up with my friends, we used to watch like the first three Die Hards like all the time. So then we found out about this movie where Bruce Willis is in space. We'd all got excited because, all right, well, this would be really kind of fun. He's kind of out of his element. In fact, I read a review. Someone stating that this movie, The Fifth Element, is a better Die Hard movie than Die Hard 5. I think it was the site Movies with Mikey. If you go onto YouTube, it's from the site Chainsaw Productions, something like that. But yeah, Movies with Mikey. When you said that on there, it made total sense. Because for those of you that don't know what The Fifth Element is about, I'm going to give just a quick little recap like I do on all of our episodes. All right, so Bruce Willis is the cab driver named Corbin Dallas, and he's kind of down on his luck. You know, he's about ready to get his cab taken away. Oh, fun note too, the voice of, I guess, his mob boss, his buddy that gives him jobs, that's Vin Diesel. And I guess he was uncredited for that role. So anyways, at one night here, he's, you know, driving his cab, and this girl literally falls into his bat seat. Now, bat story on the girl that fell into his bat seat. Well, you find out earlier back in Egypt that there are these five entities. There's like fire, wind, water, air. I'm sure Captain Planet's in here, but he's not. Heart, but no. But there's like the fifth element is like this like being, and when all these elements come together, they can help defeat evil. And so, cut to the future. Evil is now on its way to the city, or to this future. I'm pretty sure we're still at Earth, but it's like a future Earth. It's basically, I was listening to the Shat That Movie podcast, and someone said on there that it's basically Blade Runner with the lights turned on. Like Blade Runner during the day. And I have to agree with that right there. But anyways, they have to basically bring, there's like this ship of all these aliens, and they have to bring her down, but then they get attacked by some other aliens, and the ship gets destroyed, but for some reason they found a glove with their DNA in there, and the scientist was able to use their scientific mojo jojo to bring her back, and she just confused about where she is because she's in prison, and therefore she jumps into Bruce Willis's cab, and they basically try to find out more about who she is, and she tries to find out who she is, and they find out that, you know, she's this big savior, and they have to try to retrieve these other stones. And the only scenes we're going to be talking about this flick here is mainly the scenes of like Ruby Rod's introduction to this, and the big diva opera singer dance, and the big fight that Mila Jovovich has. Okay. I think I was pretty right with that description. Did I miss anything here with that description?
No, the two things I was going to say was I enjoyed the Powerpuff Girls reference you managed to throw in there,
I was doing Captain Planet.
Well, I mean, you did Captain Planet, but then you also said the Mojo Jojo. And then also as much as I like the film, I'm perfectly willing to point out when it's kind of what the hell, and the whole thing of they managed to make Lilu, who turned out to be the fifth element, from the hand of someone who was driving the ship that exploded. Not 100% sure how they did that, but anyway.
I have some questions too about where was that hand been. All right, I don't know. There are things going on there. Here's a weird thing too about this film too, because I gotta save that. I'm jumping ahead of myself here. I apologize. Well, let's do this like we always do. We're gonna take a quick little break right now. We're gonna play some ads from some other great podcast shows, and we'll be back on Cinema Recall to talk about the few key scenes from The Fifth Element.
We'll return after these messages.
Warning, the following promo contains strong language and 90s movies some may find offensive. Listener discretion is advised. Do you remember the films of the 90s? The cinematic classics that changed movie history forever. The films that created treasured memories to last a lifetime.
Who in the right mind is this fucking film aimed at?
The Video Negative Podcast remembers things differently.
Fucking dire.
My God.
Absolute idiot.
They couldn't even get the fucking colours right.
Fucking atrocious.
We're a film review podcast that looks at the worst cinematic atrocities of the 90s.
Just end it. Just end it.
It's just woeful.
There's no clear...
This doesn't even have the pretense of wanting to be a good movie.
From the biggest blockbusters to the smallest indie flicks, it's all shit and it's all game.
This isn't preteen crap.
Criminally poor.
Fucking awful.
The film is a Panic at the Disco music video on loop.
Video Negative Podcast. the film review show that criticizes The Chronic, disses the dismal, and puts the pathetic out to pasture.
I am not wasting any more of my oxygen on this film.
Check us out on SoundCloud, Stitcher Radio, and iTunes, and hit us up on Twitter at Video Negative.
I'm Clint.
And I'm Jared.
And we're the hosts of the podcast Alcohollywood,
your source for inebriation,
which you're not listening to right now because this is just a promo for a weekly podcast on all kinds of movies, new, old, good, bad.
Yeah, especially bad.
Plus, we invent a cocktail and a drinking game inspired by each film.
And sometimes we make jokes. Not this time, but sometimes.
Subscribe to us on your favorite podcatcher and check out the whole shebang at alcohollywood.com.
This podcast is a proud member of the LAM Podcasting Network. Find the network at largeassmovieblogs.com.
Here he is, the one and only winner of the Gemini Croquette Contest. This boy is fueled
like fire.
So start melting, ladies, because the boy is hotter than hot. He's hot.
Hot. Ah!
Gonna set the world on fire. Right here from 5 to 7, you know
everything
there is to know about that
D-Man.
His dream, his desire, his most intimate of intimates. And what I'm looking at, intimate is his Stud Muffin's middle name. So tell me, my man, you nervous in the service?
Not really.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Cinema Recall Podcast here on ThatMomentIn.com. So, getting into the first section here of the movie, I think we have to basically introduce the sequence when Ruby Rod is first introduced. I mean, that whole sequence when he's doing his radio show and Bruce Willis as Corbin Dallas has really no idea of what's going on there. In fact, I wouldn't be surprised... if that was like their first meeting together, is seeing Chris Tucker in those roles right there. Now, you have to understand their folks too, that Chris Tucker was mainly known for doing, like, you know, realistic characters. He's never actually played a full out character like this. I mean, I know some people can say that his role on Friday was a completely out there character, but I don't think so. Let's hear it for you, Paul. What would you think about this?
Well, I mean, it's kind of difficult for me now. Like, whenever I think of Chris Tucker, he is just Ruby Rod to me. So it's like, every time I see him, it's the hair, it's the strutting walk. Like, every time I've seen any of the Rush Hours, it's like, oh, he's just doing a toned-down version of Ruby Rod.
The way he gets people to go away, that
and the whole thing where it's almost a send-off of all of these people that are kind of C-list celebrities, but they think they're A-plus celebrities. Like, it's just that I think it's best when he's walking down doing his radio show and he just got this paintbrush that he just drapes across all of these pictures of himself, like, here we go, I'm signing, but I'm not really signing.
Okay, who were those Japanese schoolgirls?
I don't
that
know.
Right there? I have no idea, but they were just lining up in front of his doorway there. Like, and they were like his only fans that were like lining up were like these young, like, middle school age schoolgirls. It was weird.
Yeah, and one of the things that I found interesting watching it again just for this is I'd never really paid attention, but every single stewardess really is identical. It's just,
yeah,
he knocks the one away with his walking stick microphone and then he turns around the corner and it's like, did she just move round here? I don't know.
It's a different girl. What the hell happened here?
Yeah, but I find it difficult to know where to start with the scene, really. It is just, it's pure energy. which is so much fun.
This is the part of the movie where a lot of the comedic elements jumped into it. It's very fast-paced. The way the camera tracks a lot of different shots during the sequence right there. This is a scene you just gotta sit back and just watch Chris Tucker. And I really wish that on the DVD or when this movie is being promoted, I kind of wish they did have a Ruby Rod hour. I would love to hear a podcast of Ruby Rod and him doing his things they did there. But here's the weird thing, too. I guess they originally tried to get, Prince and Lenny Kravitz to be cast in here. And I watched interviews with Chris Tucker. I think I almost called him Chris Rock, and I apologize. So Chris Tucker even said that he was trying to do impersonations of both Prince and Michael Jackson. And it's one of those examples where the impression of someone else is a lot better than the actual actor playing that. Because I guarantee you, Prince would not be as, you know, out there and flamboyant as Chris Tucker is, because Chris Tucker is doing, you know, what he thinks, you know, Prince is all about. You know, Prince is all about being flamboyant, but he still gets the ladies and whatnot there, so.
Yeah, well, you know, if Prince had agreed to do it, he probably would have played it seriously.
Exactly. Yeah.
And that would not have worked.
No, not all there. But I really kind of like the whole fact when, you know, because Chris Tucker's like, you know, his mouth moves at a mile a minute. And whenever he tries to get Bruce Willis as Corbin Dallas to talk, Bruce Willis only has just one line.
Yeah. Yeah, I think my favorite bit is the second time he tried to do it, again, where he just... He knocks the stewardess out of the corridor with the stick. Just goes straight up to his mouth. And just like, what do you think? We're going to learn it? And he just goes, not really.
Yeah. Are you nervous in the service?
Yeah, it's so brilliantly points out, like, this is the exact opposite of Corbin Dallas. This is...
John McClane, all right? It's basically John McClane, all right? The whole podcast. Oh, I should be calling him John McClane instead.
Yeah. But I think we can say right here and now that it is definitely his descendant that is Corbin Dallas.
So I do want to do one more thing about the scene here. All right, so he goes to that one lady, one of the stewardess, is like, he starts saying, and I could not even pick up on all things, but he's talking very soft with her. He's like, yo, man. My man, me man. It starts like with the keep I'm like, I have no idea what's working right there. But I might try and watch this movie again with the subtitles because I'm gonna learn those lines.
Ooh. I'm licking your steps, little girl. It's 'cause the sky is clear if you ride home to mama. Ready right from 5 to 7, I'll be your voice. You done? And I'll be high on the trail of the sexiest man in the year. D-Man. Your man.
Yeah. Yeah, his voice in this is very much like sort of Gilbert Gottfried-esque. Like, it just completely stands out from everyone else. Like, you know, it's him straight away the second he starts talking. I mean, given that he's the loudest person in the room as well, so.
So basically, if like Gilbert Gottfried was a sex symbol, he would be in this world.
Pretty much.
Fair enough. There.
That would be a very different film.
Yes. So now you know we are trying to get into our main sequence, and this is the diva sequence. All right. Now.
Yes,
I do know that the sequence was actually shot at the Royal Opera House. And before we actually do get into the whole opera number, there is a small little sequence where Ruby Rod is doing his show. And he's introducing Corbin Dallas to, you know, the place the opera is. And he's going around the room. He introduces him to, I forgot his name, but this really famous composer, the singer, that won't be able to hear anything because he's stone deaf. And then he finds some, like, he shows him some prime minister's daughter, and she's like, I have her, seen in demo, if you want to hear it, and it's just her having an orgasm, and he's just kind of going around the room right there, doing the whole Ruby Rod right there. What do you think about that little part there before we get into the actual opera?
It was really fun because, like I said, like, Ruby Rod just kind of made the film for me, so just more Ruby Rod was fantastic.
Yeah.
And me being partially deaf, I did find it really funny, that thing where he's just yelling at the person, like, you won't be able to hear it because he's stone dead. And the guy just goes, huh? What? Oh, okay.
Yeah.
But yeah, that part was really cool, especially since it really shows how much Corbin Dallas can get under his skin when he says another one word line before sitting down. You just see him just screaming internally before yelling to go to commercial.
Yeah. and then we have the sequence where the curtains open and the diva shows up there, and this diva's full blue, got the big old blue dreadlocks, you know, wonderful dress right there. And she goes into this beautiful opera. I can tell you, though, that the actress who played the diva in the matrix here, her name is Mai Wen, and she was married to Luc Besson at the time. And then during shooting, Luc Besson and Mila Jovovich started having a side action going on, and then they got married right after the shoot of this movie. So... Yeah. So, yeah, do the sequence of this. It's Mai Wen as it. I'm probably saying her name wrong, and I apologize. She was a lady in the outfit. The actual person singing the actual song was a pretty famous soprano singer named Inva Mula, if I'm saying that right there. And even though...
Probably.
Well, even though, like, Mai Wen, like, her voice was dubbed, during the actual production of, you know, The Fifth Element, she actually did sing the songs, and she practiced, you know, over several weeks just to get all the right pitch and enunciations of those words there. I want to tell you my feelings about the scene here, Paul, but I want to hear what you felt about the scene when... you saw it, or what do you remember most about the scene?
Well, I can definitely tell you that what I took away from the scene when I first saw it versus what I take away from it now are two very different things. Because
okay.
When I first saw it, I was younger, and I was more focusing on the fight scene, and I just thought it was kind of cool that they had a fight scene that was going on during the latter half of this opera, where it starts to get more rocky and techno and kind of a little out there. And I always thought, oh, that's really cool. That's what I remembered from it most. And, of course, the really different fighting than anything I'd seen before. Whereas now, having been to study film studies at university and just being a lover of film, I now fully understand just how well made this scene was. Like, just how they clearly choreographed the fight around the song. And it's just so well done, where they do keep cutting back and forth at pretty much just the right time. I think it's almost a masterclass in editing.
Oh, it is very much.
This little thing. When you got a hold of me to say, hey, we're good, like doing the Fifth Element, what scene do you want to do? I pretty much like didn't have any other scene that popped into my head other than this one until I remembered Ruby Rod.
But yeah,
like, yeah, this scene is the one we need to talk about.
So. I definitely want to get more into the actual fight sequence, but I want to start with that one opera sequence because this is the moment, no matter how many times I've seen this with my friends or whatnot there, because during the movie, you know, we all can be talking with each other and kind of laughing, you know, because we watch this movie many times. But no matter how many times you watch it, when the diva starts singing, the whole room becomes quiet. It's like automatic. Once that curtain opens and you hear those first two notes right there and she sits up right there, we can have like a big, long conversation. Everyone in the room shuts their mouth when she sings the first few bars. And we have to just be quiet and just watch it. And when I saw this when I was younger, I knew nothing about opera at all. I think I've seen my mom watch it a few times, but we were never big, like, opera lovers. So I knew something of the genre, but it's not something I just stayed and watched. But when she steps out and you hear those few notes right there, I was like, all right, I'm shutting up and I am just in awe. And here's the cool thing, too. That reaction that Bruce Willis has on his face, that was the actual natural reaction because they kept My Win enclosed. No one actually got a chance to see her in makeup before the scene shot. So when the curtains open and she steps out on stage for those audience shots and you see Bruce Willis, that is his actual, like, real reaction to seeing that character.
Yeah, and there's not a lot of films that are able to really do that anymore, I feel, because it's always best to have the somewhat natural reaction, because no matter how good an actor someone is, when you just have that natural feel to it, you can, 99% of the time, you can tell. So it's just such a well-done scene all around there, I would feel, by Bresson. Like, he seemed to know his stuff.
Yeah. he's kind of a prick when it comes to cheating on people there, but hey, he's a wonderful filmmaker, so I'm not going to give him shit about that, right? But whatever words to make a great film, I'm all for it, buddy, all right? But I do like the fact that it is kind of intercut because during the fight sequence, intercut with this because during the sequence, I don't know who the names of the bad guy aliens, the shapeshifter alien dudes are.
Isn't it like
the Morg was
Mangalos
or something like that? Yeah, but they tried to infiltrate her because they want to get the stones back, and she just starts kicking all sorts of ass. And you're right, it is a masterclass in editing because you have the diva. She's doing this big opera number. And then she breaks off into, like, this pop, techno mashup of opera and dance music. And the way the diva moves on stage, does her little dance, it kind of matches up with, you know, Lilu doing her ass kicking and everything. I do like the fact, too, that there's, like, one sequence where she does, like, a high kick, and that was a movie prop that happened with that. I thought that'd be kind of cool. They used, like, old-school, like, movie techniques. And apparently that sequence took, like, a long time to film because she had to practice with other stunt doubles before they put all the makeup on and had to do it again with the makeup on there.
Yeah.
there's a lot of like visual comedy of like her like doing like a Three Stooges slapping on the face and poking on their eyes.
I rewatched this scene specifically for this, and there's a couple of things that stood out to me. Which actually, number one is at the end of the fight, it seems as though there's still one or two left that she hasn't beaten up, but that's only because of like, I think one editing choice that I thought was a bit odd, but also when she's halfway through the fight and these three other guys burst into the room, it kind of looked like they're coming out of the toilet. it's almost Vincent coming out of the toilet in Pulp Fiction type thing, where he's just kind of, huh?
Right.
So, but yeah, I really do. I rewatched this twice in a row just so I could just hear that song and see the editing and all of that again.
So,
because I enjoyed it so much.
The song that the diva sings, and the character of diva is the diva Pava Laguna. It's called the
Pava Laguna.
Thank you. Sorry, it's called the song is called the El Dosa Suno, and apparently it's an aria from the opera Lucia de Lamora. And all I know from it's supposed to be the most difficult arias because of the length. Okay, so when it gets to the whole pop sequence in there and she's doing all her vocal different arrangements right there, I knew the director wanted to have, you know, Inva Luna do all the like, weird different pitches with her voice. And she says, Luke, there's no way the human voice cannot possibly do that. So you know there's a few keyboards, elements, synthesizers added into it. But here's the cool thing, too. In fact, I'll post it on Twitter if I can find it again, or on the Facebook page. But there actually is a Japanese singer who does that opera. And she's able to do all those different vocal changes that happen in the movie, but with just her own voice. Now, she doesn't do it as quick as the diva does in the movie, but she's able to reach those pitches, and it's quite an amazing feat. I wish I knew her name, so I posted it online, but it's this Japanese singer. I don't know where her name is, and I'll try and find it later there. But if you just type in under YouTube, Fifth Element live singer, you can find it there. But I found that to be amazing.
Yeah, there was actually, and again, I don't remember the name because I saw this about 3 years ago. There was another YouTuber who specifically does this sort of singing and asked for, you know, people to say, hey, what do you want me to sing? And everyone said this, so she did it, and she spot on. Like the,
yeah.
She had nothing else in there. She was able to do all of it by herself, so it was really cool to see.
Oh. Yeah, and I think we talked about the opera right there, talked about the fight sequence. I do know that Mila Jovovich was nominated for an MTV Movie Award for Best Fight. I don't know what she... I'm sure that's not probably the high pinnacle of anyone's acting career. You never want to be known as just being only nominated for an MTV Movie Award and losing an MTV Movie Award, all right? It's just...
Yeah, and I mean, I have to say that in terms of like fight, it's fun to watch and it's obviously perfectly choreographed around the song, but in terms of best fight, I wouldn't say it was
No, no. We never got to mention all the costumes when we were talking about Ruby Rod's sequence there. But all the costumes were designed by Paul Gaultier, or I think, gosh, holy, that's his name right there.
Oh, Jean-Paul Gaultier?
Jean-Paul Gaultier, thank you very much. Jean-Paul Gaultier. And I remember him doing the costumes for the City of Lost Children. And then I saw, he also designed the Madonna cone bra. And I knew he did the costumes for this. And I find it funny. He's probably the only designer I recognized during American Psycho. When,
all right.
well, basically, Patrick Bateman is carrying out Jared Leto's body, and puts into a trunk, and a guy passes by like, oh, is that a John Paul Gaultier beige? And so that's the only connection I have between this and American Psycho is that one little sequence of his name there. But yeah, I thought all of his costumes were really good. In fact, I'm kind of surprised. I don't think this movie was ever picked up for a best costume, which I kind of I'm a little bit surprised about. I thought
you would think that the costume design would definitely win. I want to know what the winner was. Then, if it wasn't even
well one of them, yeah, no, it was nominated for an Oscar, but only nominated for like best sound effects editing for the Oscars. Yeah, nothing for costumes. I thought, well, this would be right up their alley. But then again, the Oscars during the 90s, you know, this came around the same year as like would have been like would that been the Titanic and English Patient and Amistad.
Because
Titanic was 97, wasn't it?
Still.
Well, yeah, you know, Academy people here, you know they're always gonna pick like big, elegant costumes.
Yeah, and I don't know. Now I genuinely just really want to know who who won that year. So, because I think of this is when you get into the issue of when it comes to costumes. Like, okay, are you looking for costumes that best submerge you into the time period that it's set in, or are you looking for costumes that stand out? And these costumes definitely stand out. They're so bright. They're so so brilliant for the characters that they're in. I mean, Ruby Rod's outfits are just fantastic to look at. And Plava Laguna looks fantastic. So I think this film was gypped in terms of honor, Oscar nominations.
At least for the costumes, right there. In fact, I'm just trying to find right now exactly. Who was for best costume. So basically, best costume went to the English Patient. And I was right, the other nominees, they were all period dramas. We got Hamlet. We have Emma. We have The Portrait of a Lady. And Angels and Insects were the other nominees. But these are all, 17th century type of period dramas. There really was no originality. And that's what I mean. During that time, Academy voters would be a little put off by, stuff like this. They would think it was too MTV style and, too out there, too weird for, Academy voters. So, yeah.
Yeah, I suppose.
Yeah. So, yeah. I'll throw it there. I don't know really what else to say about the sequence here. If you've never seen The Fifth Element, folks who's listening, I do recommend seeing it, though. Do you think, I'll ask you this, Paul, if this movie was released today, do you think it would be as good as it was back then? Because this movie was huge when it came out. It was a pretty good blockbuster.
Yeah. To be honest, I think if this film was made today, there would be so much less practical effects in it that it would kind of just become yet another like CG epic type thing, where I feel that it was made at just the right time before the computer graphics were getting cheap enough that people were trying to use them more. So they really only use them when they absolutely had to, and then everything else is physical. So I think that the film was made at exactly the right time. And if they made it now, you wouldn't have Bruce Willis as Corbin Dallas, and therefore I don't think you would have the same tone as you would if you hired anyone else for the role.
And that's why I kind of feel about his new film, Valerian, which I tried to go see today, but I was late, and if I caught Annette showing, I wouldn't be able to get back here in time. But the whole thing of Valerian, it almost could be a follow-up to The Fifth Element, but it does have way too many CGI going on there, and it doesn't feel like a real world. Like, even though I get that the fifth element, the world in there, is not a real world, but it feels real because, like Paul said there, they do add in a lot of practical effects to this and a lot of, like, monster makeup to meld in with the CGI. That sequence when Lilu jumps off the bridge to try to escape her captors, that's still a very effective scene. I know it's CGI, but I don't care. It still feels real because they actually did use real set pieces around the CGI. And that's one of the biggest problems I have with CGI, is that they try to have the whole world be CGI. And that shouldn't be the case. The CGI should be used to enhance a scene, not be the whole scene.
Yeah, and there are some films where you can kind of get away with that, like Sky Captain and the World of Tomorrow.
Yeah, gets away with
it because it does literally make everything green screen and everything gets added in later. Kind of like Sin City as well.
Exactly.
Like, very stylized. But yeah. this film wasn't quite that stylized, so there had to be so many physical elements in it for you to really believe it.
And that's the thing, too. I know Valerian's based on, like, a comic book, like a French comic book, so maybe it does match the artwork of the comic book series. I don't know. I'm just kind of judging it for what I've seen on trailers. I don't know anything about the movie. I'm hoping to see it soon, but there are other flicks I want to see in theaters more, so who knows? I only have a limited amount of budget votes, so I can't go out there and see everything like I want to.
Yeah, I was just going to say, the next Luc Besson film that I want to see is actually a film he made in 2010. It's called The Extraordinary Adventures of Adele Blanc-Sec.
That is so good.
And it looks fantastic, so I really want to see that soon.
That is an excellent movie. That is so... I was at a sci-fi comic book convention here in the Twin Cities, and they were playing it late at night at around, like, 12:30 in the morning. I was, like, kind of wandering around the rooms, and I see a screening for a movie from Luc Besson that has never been released called The Adventures of Adele Blanc-Sec. And I sat down, and it was a pretty good, decent-sized, you know, screen, you know, good 40-inch TV, and I was just mesmerized by that. That is, like, that for me is, like, one of the best, like, Indiana Jones mummy-style movies. If you enjoyed, like, the Indiana Jones trilogy and Brandon Fraser's Mummy, you will love this movie. Absolutely. It's a very fun adventure.
I really have to see this now.
And I wish I remember the name of the actress in this one, too, but oh, so beautiful. Yes.
Yeah, I found out about this just looking into Luc Besson, and I saw the trailer and I was like, I'm watching this. It looked very much like something I would love.
I wish the movie got a theatrical release because it's weird. A lot of the movies that Luc Besson makes in his native country, they don't come here as often. Like, Angel A is one of my other favorite movies of his, and I think it's just a beautiful black and white tale. It's a very short, like, 90-minute movie about a guy who's down his luck, tries to commit suicide, and he gets involved with this angel, and she changes his life around. Seems like a simple, dumb premise, but it's actually very beautiful, beautifully shot. The black and white is stunning. It's not distracting. It's really good. Yeah. Luc Besson always had, like, kind of a mixed bag of styles there. And yet he still produces and, you know, he writes for the Taken movies. But when he actually does get behind the camera, you know, he does know how to put some, you know, eye-popping visuals on there. So, yeah. Any other closing... Any other closing thoughts at all about the fifth element or, you know, these scenes in general?
The only thing that I ever say when I'm talking to someone that hasn't seen it is if you decide to sit down and watch it, which I heartily recommend, you need to bear in mind that this film knows what it is. So you have to not expect it to be completely, like, serious in all respects, because there are some very silly things in this. And obviously we just talked about a very good scene, but then you've also got the scene where they're, like, trying to negotiate with the bad guys that have captured the bridge. And then he just goes in and he solves the situation, which I'm not going to go any further for anyone that hasn't seen it. But yeah, it's very Bruce Willis, very, like, it's kind of John McClane if, like, John McClane just had enough from the beginning. He's just like, he's done, and they keep pulling him back. So it's like, okay. And that's what, that's who this film is based around. This is one. He genuinely had tried to get out.
So the guy who says, we're sending someone in to negotiate. His name is Lee Evans. And he was the guy.
Yes, he is.
And there's something about Mary, who had all the glasses and walked with the canes and everything, and British accents, yeah. Mm-hmm. I think that is going to wrap up this episode of the Cinema Recall podcast. I didn't talk to you about this before, Paul, and I apologize. Can you tell me a little bit more about the Blockbuster podcast and tell me, you know, what your show is about there? Tell me some upcoming episodes that you have on the way. No. I like your French fried episodes, so I want to hear about the new episodes that you and everyone was doing on there.
Okay, I'll get to future episodes in a second, but basically the Blockbuster podcast is something that myself and my podcasting partner Brian started because we really like talking about film, and we decided, hey, why not record ourselves doing that and put it out there? And so I already had a laptop. We bought a $60 mic, and we spend $10 a month on the server fees, and that's it. Like, I taught myself how to edit all this, and we just talked about film, and now we're starting to talk about other things as well as film. We've been tailoring it around our lives ever since. I now have an almost 10-month-old daughter, so the films that I can get out and see have become limited. So we've been kind of doing this, that, and the other when it comes to the main reviews. As you said, we do French Fried, which is where we're trying to prove the point that Hollywood needs to stop just making sequels to films and start trying to look at other things. So we review the latest film in a franchise we feel has gone on way too long. And we've done Police Academy, we've done Final Destination, we've done Friday the 13th, and it's been a lot of fun doing that, and also kind of difficult at times. And then we also do Film Spotlight, which is been really fun to do, where we have people on to talk about a film that they love and a film that they hate, and we just get to know the person while we're talking to them. So it's really cool look into who these people are, I find. And with regards to future episodes, I can't give you too much of a scoop here because I don't know really what the next episode is going to be, because a lot of the times what we do is we'll record the episodes, we'll put them out, and then it'll take us a few days and we'll just kind of go, so what are we doing? How about this one? Okay, 3 days later we'll record it. So it's very kind of in the moment type thing, but I do know that the next franchise we're going to do is going to be Mission Impossible.
Ooh, okay, really?
Yes, because what we started doing now is we're going to do Twitter polls after the one where we put up three different franchises. We've got a whole list. We're going to pick from that list three franchises, and then there's going to be a Twitter vote on it. The one that wins the vote is going to be the next one, and the one that's second place is going to be the one after that. So
okay.
We just did Final Destination. We're going to do Mission Impossible next, and then we'll pick three more from there.
Well, I'm very excited to see what the ones we're going to talk about, which you're going to talk about on there. Okay. All right. Nice. All right.
You on when we talk about it.
I would love that. Yeah. Speaking about polls here, because we always do polls on the Cinema Recall podcast, our next episodes, we are going to play tribute to really great acting and directing talents that we lost this month. So yes, our poll is going to be on movies from George A. Romero and Martin Landau. And here are your five choices for movies that we're going to do. We're going to do, for George A. Romero, I got to do Night of the Living Dead, Dawn of the Dead, and Day of the Dead. And then for Martin Landau, I'm going to do Crimes and Misdemeanors and Ed Wood. So those are your five. those are going to be your five choices. It's between George A. Romero and Martin Landau. I thought about maybe doing two separate episodes, but that would be just too much of a downer, you know. So yeah, we'll definitely pay respect. Doesn't matter which one you choose. We'll definitely pay respects to both of them. Also, want to pay my respects to one of the singers from Linkin Park, Chester Burningham. Yeah,
Chester Bennington.
What was that name?
It's Chester Bennington. What is his name?
Bennington. My deepest apologies. My deepest condolences go out to his fans, his friends, his family. Very tragic right there. So, in fact, we're going to close out this episode by playing a song from Linkin Park. So, as always, for the Cinema Recall podcast, we are found on the site thatmomentin.com. You can listen to our show on iTunes, on Stitcher Radio, on Podomatic, and I believe still on SoundCloud, while that site is still going on. I'm not quite sure how long that's going to be, but you can find us on there. You can always find out everything that's going on of That Moment In on Twitter at That Moment In. We're also on Facebook. Just type in That Moment In. As for me, The Vern, I am at Video Vanguard. Paul, do me a favor, man. Can you tell me everywhere they can find the Blockbusters podcast? I know you say it's like blockbusterswebs.com.
Yeah, it's blockbusters.webs.com if you're going to the website, because, hey, we don't have the money for a .com. And I know everyone said, oh, it's only $10 a year or whatever. It's like, we're on a serious budget here. This is how we're doing this. But yes, our Twitter at Blockbusters, Facebook.com/Blockbusters. We're on Instagram at Blockbusters, which I'm really trying to keep going. I'm very late to the game in that respect. You can email us blockbusterpodcast@gmail.com if you want to have like a really long conversation with us. So far, nobody has done that, but feel free to be the first.
I might do that. I'm going to take the challenge.
Okay, there we go. You can be our first proper email.
Okay.
And then if you want to follow me on Twitter for whatever reason, you can find me at His and Hurricane, which is HisAndHerricane. And that's because my nickname is Hurricane, and it was myself and my wife's Twitter before she decided she hated Twitter. So it's now all mine. And the only other thing I will say is please do go and visit our network website, which is podbros.com, because they're fantastic guys. We've been a really happy member for a long time, and there's a bunch of great other shows there. So if you like us and what we do and you want to see what else are in our network, please do stop by there and see what we have.
All right, folks, I think it's going to kind of wrap up things right now here. Thank you all for listening. And go on to the site thatmomentin.com and just vote on what our next show will be about. Again, the choices are Night of the Living Dead, Dawn of the Dead, and Day of the Dead for George A. Romero. And for Martin Landau, the choices are Crimes and Misdemeanors and Ed Wood. All right, take care, everybody. When my time comes, forget the wrongness.